Ever been ringside and got blood on you?
Oh, all the time.
This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
Anthony Joshua is a composed and ferocious finisher. Watch this.
Andy Ruiz is the heavyweight champion.
Hosted by SI's Chris Mannix.
That was really embarrassing.
That was my moment.
Now with interviews, analysis, and everything going on in the world of boxing.
When you have talent, you are given another chance.
Here's Chris Mannix.
All right, Keith Idek is back. BoxingScene.com. He is an institution in Las Vegas, just like Penn and Teller, Britney Spears. Is Elvis an institution in Vegas back in the day?
That is. That, now you're calling me fat now. With the Elvis reference. Come on.
Elvis wasn't always fat. Like, no, he was, his,
he was very, at the end, he was very fat. But
did you know him at the end? Were you friends?
My mother was a huge Elvis fan, so I'm very familiar with Elvis's antics toward the end of his life.
But, it would have been so good if you had said, like, my mother knew Elvis. And, like, all of a sudden it gets connected that way.
My mother wished she knew Elvis, I'm sure. But, but yeah, no, I feel like I have a permanent residence of some sort here for sure.
I know that feeling, man. Like pre-COVID, most summers I would spend at least 21 days probably here in Vegas between Summer League, USA Basketball, and invariably one or two fights. It would be 20 plus days. And anyone that spent time in July and August in Vegas, it is literally like flying into an oven and just parking yourself in an oven for an extended period of time.
No, it really is, Chris. And even now, for the most part, I've been here since last Wednesday, I think. So, like, whatever that is, 8 or 9 days. And other than 2 days when it was in the low 70s, kind of out of nowhere, it's been in the mid-90s and everything. And you just stay inside for the most part, you know?
Yeah, you don't hit the wave pool here at the Mandalay Bay?
As I'm sure you've realized in knowing me as long as you have, I don't tan well.
I went out to the wave pool for 45 minutes today, and I could feel myself baking.
And like you said, this is nothing like July Vegas heat, you know? So it's
July-August is... Hopefully never find out what hell is like, but July-August in Vegas, weather-wise.
We'll be here back-to-back, and you'll be here for Summer League and back-to-back big fights.
A lot of things going on in Vegas in the summertime. All right, let's jump in with what you saw last weekend live. I watched on TV. Josh Taylor unifying the 140-pound division, undisputed 140-pound champion. I thought it was a great fight. Back and forth, where the difference, quite literally, on the scorecards was the knockdowns. Josh Taylor picked up an early knockdown. I think it was, the seventh round when he had the uppercut that put Jose Ramirez down, which rocked Jose Ramirez. He wins 114-112 on all three judges' scorecards. Give me your impressions of what you saw from Taylor and Ramirez.
Really impressed with Josh Taylor, of course. I thought I had him winning 115-111. Of course, several rounds could go one way or the other. Particularly,
whenever it's one round, it doesn't really...
And the first five rounds of the fight, I mean, there were a couple of rounds I thought could have gone either way. But Taylor was really impressive, primarily to me, because Jose Ramirez laid it on him so badly during the third round, I started to think, well, maybe he's just going to overwhelm Josh Taylor and maybe not necessarily get him out of there in the third round, but maybe get him out of there. And Taylor really recovered from that well, just as Jose Ramirez deserves a lot of credit for coming back, particularly from the second knockdown. The first knockdown was a really perfectly placed shot, I thought, from Josh Taylor. He stepped back and really caught him with a good shot.
Ramirez coming in to...
More of a flash knockdown, less than 10 seconds into the sixth round. The second one, he was badly hurt. Now, Ramirez tried to say after the fight that he wasn't badly hurt. He was badly hurt. And if Josh Taylor has a little more time, either from Kenny Bayless or if it was a little earlier in the round, maybe he finishes Jose Ramirez in that seventh round. Just out of curiosity, I'll ask you a question for a change. What was your perspective on the way Kenny Bayless handled that?
I thought Kenny Bayless bailed Jose Ramirez out. I thought he gave him three or four extra seconds that might have made the difference for Josh Taylor. I'm with you. Jose was hurt in that seventh round. He caught a flush uppercut. He did not have his legs under him. And Kenny Bayless is like counting, and then he's going back and, pushing Taylor back, didn't really need to be pushed back. It was just a weird situation that Kenny seemed determined to give Ramirez that amount of time.
When I went back and, I wrote a story on it the next day, and I counted the seconds and everything from the time on the clock, on the ESPN clock, it was either 21 or 22 seconds went by from the time Jose Ramirez hit the canvas.
That's an eternity.
Until the time that they were brought together. Now, it's never going to be 10 seconds because the guy has to get, they have to wipe his gloves off and check that he's okay. But 21, 22 seconds is obviously, like you said, a very long time, Chris. So he got the I thought Jose Ramirez got the benefit of the doubt there because I think Josh Taylor had maybe 10 seconds, maybe 9 seconds to finish him off, which is not a lot of time. However, I think Kenny Bayless mishandling separating them from that clinch put Jose Ramirez in a vulnerable position where Josh Taylor, and I don't fault Josh Taylor at all, you protect yourself at all times, and he's just taking advantage of a situation. But Kenny Bayless, numerous times before that, particularly in the fifth round when there was a ton of clinching, he stepped between them and physically separated them almost every time. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of times when he tapped the guy's arm, but I'd say 75-80% of the time, he was literally physically separating
them. I thought
he
was too involved in that sense, too. Like, yeah. I would have liked to have seen him let some of those clinches go a little bit longer
and let them work out of it. Right, but if you're Jose Ramirez, again, protect yourself at all times, don't let your guard down. And to Ramirez's credit, he did not blame Kenny Bayless at all, whereas everyone on social media and even some of us in the media were saying, hey, you know, Bayless did him wrong in that sense. He took full responsibility for it. He said it's a mistake on my part. He didn't use the word rookie mistake, but he said it's inexperience on my part for, you know, basically saying I'm a fighter with a lot of experience. I'm a world champion. I should know better. So he took the blame for it, which I give him a lot of credit for. But I think Bayless put him in position, you know, for that to happen, and that it never should have happened. But once it did happen, he probably should have been knocked out in the seventh round, as Josh Taylor later said.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it is kind of a teaching lesson for any boxer, though. Like, you know, Jose Ramirez went down because he relaxed. Like, he let his guard down. He let his body kind of untense, and he got hit clean that way. And that was the biggest part of the impact, I thought, that, you know, he caught him just completely defenseless in that way. His own clean punch by Josh Taylor. Again, not an issue there. But, you know, Ramirez anticipated the break, and you can't anticipate the break, no matter under any circumstances.
Absolutely. The other thing that I don't like, Chris, I'm wondering what you're feeling on this, is I don't like when referees tap guys' arms or hold down their arm while they're in a clinch.
Yeah.
It's too involved, and it also, in this case, it didn't matter. It actually benefited Josh Taylor. But if you're pulling another guy's arm down, it then puts him in a vulnerable position where he might get hit off a clinch, and then what do you do? Like, you're holding his arm. The referee's responsible then for holding down one of his arms, and if a guy tries to hit him off the break, then what do you do?
Yeah,
I don't like that tactic.
The best referees are invisible ones, and I like the ones that kind of hang back and just shout at them. Be like, work out, don't hold. You know, give them opportunities, especially early in the fight, to work themselves out. And if they don't, then get in there. You know, if they're not, if they're just hanging all over each other, then get in and start to separate them. But great win for Josh Taylor. So do you assume that at some point, probably early next year, we get Taylor versus Terrence Crawford? Or is there a chance Teofimo Lopez works himself into that mix? Because you were at Teofimo's open workout this week. He seems very interested in that Josh Taylor fight at 140.
Yeah, one thing Teofimo Lopez did say, though, is that he expects, and I don't blame Josh Taylor for this at all, if he wants to keep all four titles, and he worked so hard to get all four titles, he's going to have to make a mandatory defense against Jack Catterall next, as you know, Chris. That's a long overdue mandatory. And it's the kind of fight where you can make it a homecoming fight for Taylor when things opened up in Scotland. He has mentioned he wants to fight at Edinburgh Castle for Easter Road, I think it's called. It's a soccer stadium there from his favorite soccer team when he was a kid.
And make a boatload of money.
He deserves that. I mean,
Catterall's not a dumb fight either. He's undefeated.
And he's
Taylor
British,
wins.
And he's a British fighter who's undefeated.
It's a solid domestic fight.
And he's the mandatory. Yeah. So there's no way around it. So Teofimo Lopez thinks that he'll fight Catterall next, although he wasn't even quite clear on Catterall's name. He did say that he expects him to do that next. And then from his own perspective, the way he said it was, I don't want to go out at 135 with Kambosos. So, of course, he's expecting to beat George Kambosos on June 19th, assuming he does that. He wants Devin Haney, obviously. I mean, that's what he wants. That's what he really wants, and he's hoping to force the WBC to force Devin Haney to do it, and from his perspective. So I wouldn't expect to see that next, but I'm not sure what to make of Terrence Crawford at this point. You know, we know when his contract is going to come to an end with Top Rank. I don't see any reason why he wouldn't fight Josh Taylor. Crawford would clearly be the favorite in that fight. Big opportunity for Josh Taylor.
Big time fight too.
Yeah, big time fight. I mean, if you're him, you have so many options now because you go do this, you get this mandatory out of the way. Assuming he wins that, you could stay at 140, and there are The Mikey Garcia fight would be a very good fight at 140 for him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if those are as lucrative as maybe, but maybe the right, if the right people come along and pay for it, it, you know, it could be more lucrative than Teofimo Lopez. I don't know about the Crawford. I think the Crawford fight would probably be the biggest one for Josh Taylor, but it's also probably the most dangerous because he's a bigger guy and, you know, and a better fighter.
Look, if you're Josh Taylor, you take the Catterall fight whenever you take it, you know, fall, basically, and then see what's out there. Like, if Teofimo decides he's done at 135, that's an incredibly lucrative fight. If Crawford is still searching around for somebody to fight, which is distinctly possible at this point, I don't know what Crawford's future looks like, short and long term, yeah, get a bidding war going. Like, you know, you've got all four of those titles. You've got leverage here. And you could always kind of hold on to them and take another mandatory if you want in your backyard and make a decent amount of money. So I think Josh Taylor's put himself in a huge position to make a pile of money over the next couple of years. Jose Ramirez, I didn't feel like he's a big loser in all this. Like, he fought well, let his guard down, got knocked down. That was the difference in the scorecards. I don't think a lot of shine came off him in this one. What do you think?
Yeah, I think particularly because of the way he came back in the championship rounds.
Yeah, he won rounds. Three of the four,
right.
All four,
yeah,
one
exactly.
Card. Like,
yeah.
I mean, he's,
yeah, he really came back in the championship rounds. And I'm not saying that Taylor faded necessarily, but it seemed like he was trying to conserve his energy. He didn't throw nearly as many punches in the championship rounds as he had in the earlier rounds, of course. And I think he felt, and it was a dangerous game for him to play as it turned out, I think he felt maybe he had built a bigger lead than he really had. You would think he would have known better because going into the fight, he had real problems with the judging panel, which was the same exact judging panel, although experienced at the highest level, that judged the Victor Postol Jose Ramirez fight, which some people thought Jose Ramirez lost. Some people thought it was a draw. And all three of those, well, two of those judges scored it for Ramirez. So he did make a big deal about it before the fight. But he did protest, his camp did protest one of the judges that was actually, when they presented them with the pool of judges, he objected to one of the judges that actually scored the fight. So you would think he would have gone about it in a little different way because clearly he was giving away some rounds there toward the end. Mm. And as you said, the knockdowns were the difference on the cards.
I look for, and I know you do too, like, wherever they're from, the best judges in boxing, Steve Weisfeld, widely regarded as one of, not the best judge in boxing. However he scored the Ramirez-Postol fight, like, whatever. Like, you know, I want that guy ringside, yeah, you know, calling a big fight.
He had it the widest, and obviously I'm very familiar with Steve, another Jersey guy I've known for a long time.
You guys all, like, have each other's phone numbers, right?
Of course, you know, of course. It's all, you know, we all watch The Sopranos together and Jersey Shore and the like.
Wow, Jersey Shore and The Sopranos together. That's impressive.
Could you imagine a viewing party of the Jersey Shore at Steve Weisfeld's house, how that would go?
So what do you think Ramirez does, though, from here? I mean, like, a natural reaction to losing a fight oftentimes is I'm going to move up in weight. Ramirez has been at 140 for some time now. I don't think he needs to. I think there are still probably bigger makeable fights for him at 140 than there are at 147. So I think staying there at 140, if he gets in that Mikey Garcia, Teofimo Lopez mix, as, you know,
Ramirez,
guys, Ramirez I'm talking about, yeah.
Yeah, well, he can't fight Mikey Garcia, but...
Oh, yeah, the stable,
but that would be a good fight. I'd love to see it. Two reasons, of course, why he can't fight Mikey Garcia, because they're trained by his by Mikey
Robert,
Garcia's
yeah.
older brother, Robert, and I don't really know that Mikey can, although he has kind of said that he's open to doing business again with Top Rank. I don't know that that's actually possible.
I think Mikey at this point just needs to do business with somebody.
But I also think he's such a smart businessman and has navigated his career in a way that I think he would work with pretty much anyone. You know?
Yeah. He's also winning, like, the Amir Khan Award for chasing a fighter around for the last 2 years. Like, he's been chasing Pacquiao now for since a year ago, February. Like, it just, he's got to get back in the ring, get somebody at some point.
Yeah, but he's made so much money, as you know, Chris. He's, you know, he's comfortable. He's
like $7 million for that fight he had against Jesse Vargas.
Yeah. I mean, and he's a principled guy who literally, I wouldn't say squandered, because it worked out perfectly for him and worked out the way that he had hoped. But he didn't fight for 2.5 years. I mean, there's not too many guys on principle who would just sit out 2.5 years and kind of waste a lot of their prime earning, you know, time at the time of their career. He more than made up for it with the fights that he's had against Spence and Vargas and others. But
so what do you think Ramirez does then? Do you think he hangs out at 140? Because he deflected after the fights, and I'm not ready to consider that. But what do you think he winds up doing?
I think it depends on what's presented to him. There are good fights for him at 140, though. I mean, the Regis Progre fight would be, I'm not saying next because I think he'll probably take some sort of, you know, tune-up type fight probably next.
I'm also not sure Regis can ever make 140 again. He might be.
Well, yeah.
He might have reached that point.
Yeah. And he did say that, I heard him say recently that he's got some kind of nutritionist that he really believes in and whatever, but he missed weight for his last fight. So, yeah, so who knows? And he's, I don't know that that's the biggest fight there for Regis. I mean, he wants the Broner fight, which I don't really see happening because I don't think Broner is going to fight him. But he wants a Josh Taylor rematch. There are other fights that I think Progre would love to fight Crawford if he got the opportunity. So, and as you said, he might belong at welterweight now more than junior welterweight. So, but there are options there for Jose Ramirez at 140 for sure.
Mm. All right, so I'm sitting at my house last Friday watching the Ramirez and Taylor weigh in, watching the coverage afterwards where Ramirez and Taylor are kind of scuffling in the hallway. I'm scrolling through Twitter, and lo and behold, a Manny Pacquiao tweet comes out where it's Pacquiao Spence 2021, August 21st, 2021 on Fox pay-per-view. Let me start here. How shocked were you to see that tweet from Manny Pacquiao?
Well, that day I was surprised. We had gone to lunch right after the weigh-in, and then my phone starts blowing up and everything. The one thing I will say is I was told by someone very close to Manny Pacquiao in the beginning of April that unequivocally he is not fighting Terrence Crawford on June 5th. There's nothing to this. The money's not there, yada, yada, yada. Don't worry. It ain't happening. But don't be surprised if he fights Spence and not Ugas. I was told that the first week of April. Mm-hmm. Turned out to happen. I was surprised last Friday when it came to fruition. But also, when Manny announces something like that, well, he has announced fights before that never happened. He's done this with Amir Khan. So you had to verify that it was actually true. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Spence, you know, put up his own posts and everything, and I, you know, confirmed it with PBC and all, but as we all did. But it was surprising. I mean, Chris, it's amazing where we've gone. We're over a 5-day span last mm-hmm. week. We went from having Tyson Fury and Anthony Joshua fighting in Saudi Arabia August 14th, and Spence, you know, maybe fighting Ugas in a fight that I don't really think people would have been all that interested in, to having Fury Wilder 3 and Spence Pacquiao within a 4-week span in Vegas this summer. It was such an incredible turn of events. And in boxing, they don't keep much, you know, not that the Fury Wilder thing was a secret because mm-hmm. we all knew about the arbitration, but it was a pretty interesting turn of events there to have these two huge fights, despite what people might think of Deontay Wilder going into the third fight. It's a big event.
Are you surprised, though, that Pacquiao, I mean, all that being said, like 2 years ago, it seemed like Pacquiao wanted nothing to do with Errol Spence. Like, you remember when Spence beat Mikey Garcia and Pacquiao climbs into the ring? Mm-hmm. And Pacquiao, I think, was there hoping that, like, Garcia would win. Because Pacquiao's always wanted that Garcia fight because that's a more winnable fight. Yeah. There's money in it. It's marketable. Freddie Roach been pushing for that fight for a long time. I think there's pictures out there. You can look them up on Twitter, like, of Pacquiao standing next to Spence and looking like he wanted nothing to do with it. Now here we are 2 years later, 42 years old. He will be, 25 months removed from his last fight, and he's getting in with arguably the top dog in the division. I give Pacquiao insane credit. If he finds a way to beat Errol Spence, I'd have to think about it, but that would jump him many spots up the all-time rankings, yeah, to me. To be 42 and to beat a mid-20 or 30-something-year-old Spence, that would be remarkable. But I'm trying to process why he's doing it. Is it just like the money is going to be so big, or you think there's another reason?
I think the money is, it's an enormous sum of money. It has to be, because this doesn't make sense on a lot of levels. None of the numbers are favorable toward Manny Pacquiao. He's 42 years old. He's 5'6", maybe. He hasn't fought, and as you said, it'll be 2 years and 1 month by the time he steps in the ring with Spence. There's nothing numerically that favors him going into this fight. And, oh, by the way, the guy he's fighting is a monster and clearly proved against Danny Garcia that he is the same fighter that he was before he got into that horrific car accident. So the money, and look, I'm sure you have, just as I have, been trying to find out what the guarantee is, right?
Desperately.
But it has to be enormous, because I always thought that Manny Pacquiao, when he did climb back into the ring, would squeeze two more paydays out of his celebrated career. Now, I'm not saying he would have beat Mikey Garcia. That's not an easy fight either. Mm-hmm. But it's a more winnable fight, and I think all of our opinions, than Errol Spence, right? So you figure he rolls the dice with Mikey Garcia. He gets paid a lot of money. He wins. The Spence fight is there. Then he cashes out with the Spence fight. Going straight to the Spence fight, I have to be honest, other than what I was told in early April, as I mentioned earlier, I didn't see it coming. Because it's a tall order, literally and figuratively, and man, you need a dump truck for what Manny Pacquiao's got. I mean, come on, Jesus,
it's remarkable, and I agree. I mean, the pandemic obviously screwed up every plan Pacquiao had. Like, he probably would have fought in the Middle East, maybe against Mikey Garcia, maybe against Amir Khan, winnable fights that would have brought a lot of money because of the Middle East money that probably would have been available to him. But here he is, you know, and I always ask these questions where this PBC money comes from, because it seems like a lot is going out and not as much is coming in. But he's got to be getting a massive guarantee, as you said, for this fight. Spence must be getting a massive guarantee for this fight. I'm curious to see what it does on pay-per-view. Summer months, hit or miss sometimes, but this should get some good traction. Best 147, arguably, in Spence. Pacquiao, a living legend, a king-making type of event. Even with WrestleMania potentially being in Vegas over that same weekend, it still should be a wild scene. It's a crowning achievement if Pacquiao is able to do. I mean, I guess let's look at it quickly through this lens. If Pacquiao beats Errol Spence, would you place Pacquiao ahead of Floyd Mayweather on your all-time pound-for-pound list?
probably not. Because,
no?
Because when they fought, look what happened.
They did. They did.
You know what I mean? So
yeah.
They're basically, I mean, Floyd's older than him, so, you know. So when they fought, I think you'd have to go based on the head-to-head matchup. But as you said, I think you'd have to move Manny Pacquiao. I think Manny Pacquiao's extremely high on everyone's list in terms of all-time greats. But, wow. I mean, if he were to beat Errol Spence, who's, what is he, 31
maybe?
Years old? Yeah, I think he's 31 years old now, so... Man,
removed from the car crash.
That's
like, you know, that's not even an issue
anymore.
Danny Garcia settled that.
See, the thing is, and Crawford actually said this, not that there was any real threat of that fight happening at any point soon, but Crawford said he even if he were offered the Spence fight, he's not sure that he would have taken it coming off the car accident, because he felt like if he won...
Yeah.
Now, when push came to shove, maybe he would have done it, but... He said he kind of felt like if he won, he would not have been given the credit that he felt he deserved for winning that fight, because they would have said, oh, he was not the same after the car accident.
Yeah.
That's been dispelled now. He is the same after the car accident. And for Pacquiao to do this, I mean, I can't emphasize enough, Chris, as I think both of us have indicated here, how much credit Manny Pacquiao deserves for doing this. I mean, it's an incredible challenge for a guy his age, his size, coming off a two-year layoff. He was very good against Keith Thurman, and Keith Thurman mm-hmm. is an elite welterweight also. Not as good as Errol Spence, I don't think, but an elite welterweight, and he beat him. He knocked him down, beat him on the cards. You know, Keith Thurman's the same age, basically the same mm-hmm. age as Spence. I think he's 32 now. So, I mean, I can't say enough good things about Pacquiao doing this.
I know there's the head-to-head, and you're right. You know, they fought each other in 2015. Mayweather won, wide decision. But given that Pacquiao, even at this stage of his career, is fighting the very top guys. Like, 2 years ago, Keith Thurman was arguably the top guy at 147. Arguably. Like, he had, you know, I mean, he had a long layoff. I get that. Like, you know, but there was a stretch over those 3 years that he was considered number one. Still undefeated, you know, so he was up there, 1, 2, or 3, like right at the top. Spence, same thing, arguably top guy. Whereas Mayweather, my biggest issue with Mayweather, I'm not a Floyd hater either, but like, since De La Hoya, like, it's always been something about every one of his opponents. Like, something, whether it's Shane Mosley is a little bit older than what he once was. Miguel Cotto a little bit older than what he once was. Canelo a little bit younger than what he once was. Then he's Andre Berto and Marcos Maidana. Like, these were, I think, I mean, Pacquiao's resume, to me, is stronger. And that matters.
Look, Pacquiao has fought an incredible list of fighters. I do think sometimes the hatred for Floyd Mayweather from his detractors kind of blurs what he actually did.
Mm.
Because, yes, you could say that Canelo was not quite ready for that fight, but Canelo was I don't know, how many years into his career at that point when they fought? I mean, he had been a pro for a very long time. He turned pro at 15 years old. He's 23 years old.
Really 3 years, though, of fighting real guys. Like,
true,
you know,
true. But he was also, yeah, as you advance into your late 20s, that's more of your physical prime than 23. But I don't look at that fight as Floyd Mayweather taking advantage of a young kid who didn't know how to fight. And Floyd Mayweather was old at that point. He was, how old was Floyd when he fought him? 36?
Was it eight years ago? I think he was in his mid to late 30s.
I believe he was 36 years old when that fight happened in September of 13. So he's well out of his physical prime at that point. Canelo's not really that bigger than Floyd, but point being, he fought
also the worst game plan in the history of game plan.
It was, but a young undefeated star fighter. Now, of course, he's become the biggest star in American boxing since then. But that's a really good win, and beating De La Hoya, who was much bigger than him, in the back end of his career, a really good win. The point being, I think, and when he fought Pacquiao again, Floyd was the older fighter, and he beat him easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then Manny made the excuse with the shoulder and all that. So the other thing, and Pacquiao has showed a remarkable ability to come back from one really devastating loss. Yeah, Floyd Mayweather's never knocked unconscious, you know. Say what you will about his matchmaking and how careful he was at certain points in his career. Some of that criticism, I believe, is fair, but he never lost.
Right.
There's something to be said for that. He retired undefeated. He did it his way. He made almost $1 billion, for God's sake, in boxing alone.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of hard to argue with.
I agree with all that. It's a debate, right? It's like it's always going to be subjective. I just look at Pacquiao's resume with, like, I mean, hell, four fights with Juan Manuel Marquez, a Hall of Famer himself. I mean,
one thing I'll say, did Floyd ever do something like this, what Manny Pacquiao's doing? Of course not.
No.
This is unprecedented. The guy's 42. Coming off a 2-year layoff against a beast who's never been beaten.
I'm actually surprised to a degree that Pacquiao's didn't try harder to do something like, you know, fight the equivalent of Conor McGregor. Fight Conor McGregor! Like, do, you know, try to cash in a very easy payday the way...
Who's saying he won't?
That's true. Yeah, he's still got time. But, I mean, if you get knocked out, then it becomes less... If, like, Spence beats you to a pulp, that it becomes less appealing to watch that fight.
The thing that makes me cringe a little bit about this fight, as intriguing as it is trying to see Pacquiao pull this off, it's a dangerous fight for Pacquiao. And you don't want to see the guy get the crap beat out of him by a guy who's in his physical prime, much bigger, a stronger fighter.
Completely
agree.
That's why Mikey Garcia was a smarter idea, because Mikey could beat him, but he wasn't going to beat him up.
Right.
You know, Pacquiao could lose like a 16-12 decision and, I don't have anything left. Spence could leave him on his back. That's just not the lasting image we want of an all-time great. But, hey, that's his choice, and I give him a ton of credit for going out there and doing something like that. It's going to be a huge event on August 21st. Let's finish with what we're going to see this weekend. Devin Haney taking on Jorge Linares. Biggest name on Haney's resume to date, Linares, multi-division world champion. Even at 35 years old, still a threat, still powerful. He bounced back well from the knockout loss at 140 to Pablo Cesar Cano. How dangerous is Linares in this fight?
You know, Chris, it's interesting that is Linares what he was the night that he fought? Is he closer to what he was the night he fought Lomachenko, when he knocks him down, when he's ahead on one scorecard when the fight ends? Or is he closer to Pablo Cesar Cano, that version of Linares, who was knocked down three times and stopped in the first round? I understand that he moved up 5 pounds. He did, you know, he moved up from 135 to 140 for that fight, but he didn't move up multiple divisions or anything like that. So, you know, that counts. I mean, even though he was out of the division where he's done his best work, it still counts. So that's in the back of everyone's minds as well. Is, you know, he did come back. He had a very good win in his last fight, a fourth round knockout, but he hasn't fought in 15 months. So it's tough to say. One interesting thing that I found when I had ESPN on in the room before, and the Daily Wager show, one of the, you know, professional gamblers on there actually picked Linares as his best bet of the weekend.
Because he's a, like, monster underdog in this fight.
The odds on the fight are a little out of whack.
Wacky. Yeah, like, for a guy that can still crack at least.
Right.
Like,
right.
Insane.
So I think it's plus 750 or plus 800
or something. At one point, he was plus 1,100.
Right.
At one point.
Yeah, I think people have been betting Linares, I guess, at this point. But look, how often does a boxing match register on the Daily Wager show or anything like that on ESPN as a best bet or anything? And the guy was pretty confident, and I think he's also the guy in the show.
As we sit here with Jake Quigley running by, fighting on the undercard against Shane Mosley. You gotta love doing podcasts in the middle of the hallway.
It's fight week, you know. So my point is, you know, a guy who just won like $300,000 bet is calling this his best bet of the weekend. So that's interesting. So for whatever that's worth.
And
I'm
as
sure
we
sure he's been wrong a lot of times too, but
we continue to sit here as Joe Markovsky walks by doing the
he's going to the pool apparently.
going to the pool. This is podcasting in real time. yes. I have a feeling Linares is going to be impressive. I don't know what that means, whether he wins or not, but I think he's going to be impressive. I spent some time talking to him on Thursday. And look, fighters say a lot of things, but Linares and his team reminded me that they do their best work when they go to Japan, right? Like every time he goes to Japan, he comes back, he's successful. When he stays in the U.S. and trains, it often doesn't work out. He is comfortable now working with his brother, Carlos, who is his head trainer. That seems to be a really strong relationship. He moved up to 140 because he was having problems making weight at 135. He was telling me how easy it was to make weight in this fight, and you could, it didn't seem like lip service. Like he's bouncing around, he's answering all the questions with real good energy. Those are, Keith, usually signs that a guy is telling the truth, that a guy is like on weight and this is a healthy way of making weight. So I think what it's going to come down to is how good is Devin Haney? Like, do we know yet how good Devin Haney is? He has shown flashes of everything, speed, power, technical skill. He layered his camp this time around. Ben Davison is hanging around. He spent some time working with Devin and, you know, credit Bill Haney, by the way, his father and trainer, for not stepping aside. He's still the head trainer, but, you know, saying, Devin, we're going to bring other voices. You decide what you want to hear. So I think Devin is getting good information, but I think we're going to find out in this fight how good Devin Haney really is.
Yeah, and that's, of course, why we're here, Chris, to find out. You know, this is a step up for him. You know, it's a very different three-division world champion than the three-division champion he fought in his last fight. Gamboa was a month shy of his 39th birthday when they fought. You know, he's been faded for a couple of years now, has been beaten multiple times. This is a different...
Were you disappointed in that performance?
Well, he won all 12 rounds on two of the scorecards. Linares, I had a similar conversation with Linares yesterday as well. You know, he told me how much he's a different fighter when he trains in Japan, and he was there pre-lockdown, and he spent the whole pandemic there until last Friday when he came to the U.S. and all that. But he told me several things about what he, without giving away his game plan or anything, he did say, look, there were things in the Gamboa fight that Gamboa accomplished. He just, you know, he doesn't have the legs that he once had anymore. He's a smaller fighter to begin with, probably not really a lightweight. But he did some things where when he pressured Devin Haney, and when he cut the ring off against Devin Haney, when he's able to do those things, he was able to have some success. Now, obviously not enough success to make any difference on the scorecards, but from a technical perspective and from a strategy perspective, Jorge Linares noticed some things that Gamboa did that he feels will work against Haney as well. So he's a really confident fighter, as you said, Chris. He seems really comfortable. There didn't seem to be any nervousness about him or anything. I mean, he seems to think that Devin Haney is in over his head on Saturday night. I wouldn't quite say that. I mean, but, you know, or I don't think that at all, actually. But he seems to think that he's in for a rude awakening on Saturday night when he's in there with a guy who can punch, who's a very diverse offensive fighter. But, of course, on the flip side of it, he has been stopped five times. You can't look past that. You can't just, you know... The Cano fight happened at 140 pounds, fine, but he's been stopped four other times, including once another time in the first round, one other time in the second round, and once in the 11th. You know, he's been stopped multiple times in fights. So the one thing I'll say that I understand that Devin Haney can't run around here all week saying, I'm going to knock Jorge Linares out, because if you don't, then you're going to have to answer to that after the fight. It's not a smart thing to do before the fight. If you're a massive puncher, you can say whatever you... Deontay Wilder, you can say he's going to knock out anyone. Mm-hmm. It doesn't... Yeah, of course. But Haney's not a huge puncher, and I think he's trying to avoid putting himself into a position where if the fight goes the distance on Saturday night and he looks really good, he's not left answering questions. Well, you said you were going to stop this guy. Five other guys did it. Why didn't you do it? Mm-hmm. You know, so he's been real careful about that. But if he's not at least... dominant, which is a word that he used in the press conference today. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that says about Devin
Haney. What does he gain from an 11-1 decision? I mean, he and I have had this conversation. I've talked about it on the air where I've kind of put him in that Demetrius Andrade kind of sphere where you are incredibly talented, you win fights by wide decisions, but one of the reasons you don't get into big fights is because you don't look spectacular. You don't create a mandate with, you know, knockouts. The difference, and, you know, Bill Haney brought this up to me, and I agree with him. Like, Devin's never let anyone off the hook in the way that Demetrius Andrade has. Demetrius Andrade, in recent fights anyway, has let Luke Keeler off the hook. He has let Maciek Soletsky off the hook. He has allowed guys to complete fights or go deeper into fights, whereas Devin Haney hasn't done that. I don't think that Yuriorkis Gamboa came to win that fight against Haney. I think he came to survive. Right. And I can't blame Haney for sweeping and when Gamboa is not presenting the type of openings that he was against Terrence Crawford and many others that he's fought. But does he need to do something different to put himself into that conversation with the Teofimos, with the Ryan Garcias, or will, you know, a dominant decision do it?
To answer your original question, is an 11-1 type of win good enough? I think it depends what type of 11-1 win we're talking about. Is he beating up Jorge Linares? Does he drop him a couple of times? How does he beat him? You know, does he just comfortably outbox him? Does he just use his jab, fight off his back foot, not really take any chances and kind of coast to a, you know, 119-109 win or something like that and not really, you know, go for it, so to speak? Or does he try to get Jorge Linares out of there because, again, he's been stopped five times? You know, there'd be no crime in the fight going the distance if he hurts Linares a couple of times or drops him a couple of times and doesn't get the knockout. Ideally, of course, that would happen. But I think really it depends what type of win. If it's a wide win on the scorecards, what type of wide win is it? And I think that'll tell us a lot about what Devin Haney's capable of doing in the foreseeable future. Because as you said, commercially, people want to see him knock people out. But I do think if he really beats up Jorge Linares on Saturday night and still goes the distance, but he beats him up and he looks really good, you know, the interest will intensify for the Teofimo Lopez fight. I think people are going to want to see that fight anyway, mm-hmm. even if he won the type of fight that he won against Gamboa, against a better fighter. There's going to be interest in that fight because they've talked a lot of trash. They're both young, undefeated champions. You have this beef over the WBC title. I mean, the promotion kind of is already ready to go. So,
I think it would be an entertaining promotion and a high-level fight. Like, that is the fight that needs to happen next for both these guys. If Haney gets through Linares and Lopez gets through Kambosos, that's a fight for the fall that you have to make. I love Teofimo's idea of the WBC ordering a purse bid. Like, Teofimo, I don't think he wants the franchise championship. He wants to be known as the WBC champion. Like, he doesn't... I think he's as tired of this crap as Haney is right now. I mean, so I think that I love the idea of the WBC ordering the purse bid and then just dismissing the franchise championship. Like, you don't need it in this case. You never did need it, but you don't need it here.
It just shouldn't exist, of
course,
Chris. No,
it's stupid. You know, by the way, wasn't this a title that you weren't supposed to transfer it originally?
That is exactly what they said when they designated Canelo. They said,
what are we doing?
They literally stated in the press release that they sent that this is a special non-transferable designation. And oh, all of a sudden, you can transfer it or win it or lose it or whatever.
It's like they write their rules in pencil.
Yeah,
it's,
you just really... This is nonsense. We shouldn't even be talking about this. The sanctioning bodies were absurd before this franchise thing popped up 2 years ago. And now it's just... Yeah. See, I see it from both perspectives, and I get Devin Haney's gripe. He was the mandatory challenger for Lomachenko. He wanted the fight, and Lomachenko either did not want to fight him or wanted to fight Teofimo Lopez more. Now, it's kind of hard to fight. It's not like Lomachenko didn't fight Haney and then went and took a soft touch. Mm-hmm. He went and fought a young, strong guy who beat him. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of... So from Lopez's perspective, he's like, hey, man, I, all you guys are, you know, paying all this lip service to who you'll fight and you'll fight anybody and blah, blah, blah. Well, I went and fought the guy and I beat him. So how am I not the undisputed champion? Mm-hmm. From on a technical level, I see where Haney's coming from, but it's kind of hard to say that Haney is more of a legitimate champion or it's damn near impossible to say
it's
that
impossible.
Haney's
it's not Devin's fault. Like it's
right. He's just exploiting the system, like Lopez, like all the fighters.
And like he initially won the interim, then it was elevated, and then it's like this whole thing just gives even the most ardent of boxing fans a headache. It's just exhausting to kind of spend capital doing talking about stuff like this. But I think Teofimo loves a good purse bid. Because he gets paid off them purse bids. But you know what, Keith? He's probably right. That's a great way for both these guys to get paid. Like, you send this to purse bid. I mean, unless Triller comes in again with a massive thing, which I guess you can't rule out. Like, Eddie probably wins, I'm guessing, that purse bid. Like, he'll dig deep into the deep pockets he's got going on right now.
Yeah.
But if you're top rank, like, you get paid off it again, you know, on the Teofimo stuff. And that's another, it's a winnable fight for him. Like, Devin's an excellent fighter, but it's not like Teofimo would be this huge underdog, if at all, in a fight like that.
Yeah, I don't think he would be the underdog at all, to be honest with you. But top rank would be in a kind of a precarious position there, because I don't think ESPN would want them to lose back-to-back Devin Teofimo Lopez fights to a purse bid or being outbid for the fight. So maybe they're either afforded more money from their budget.
Good. By the way, great.
Right. But they're already paying top rank a lot of money every year, so it's like maybe they have to try to figure it. Could you put that fight on pay-per-view? Well, look, if you can put Teofimo Lopez and George Kambosos on pay-per-view, you can put
Teofimo.
Really
no,
but I'm saying they did. I don't expect it to do a high buy rate, but if you can do that, you certainly could put Lopez and Haney on pay-per-view. So, but I guess what I'm saying ultimately is that I don't think that top rank can put itself in a position where it loses back-to-back fights with a guy who won the biggest fight of his career against arguably the, you know, it was certainly one of the three best pound-for-pound fighters in the world at the time. It wouldn't make much sense to lose two. Now, I didn't think it made a lot of sense to lose one of his fights, let alone back-to-back fights.
Do you think, I mean, what do you make of that relationship now? You know, top rank, from when I talk to people over there, one of the things I hear is they're angling maybe to make a rematch with Lomachenko. I don't know how Lopez feels about that. I don't think that's going to happen. So, like, if you don't have that fight and you can't make a Taylor fight for before the end of the year, what do you do? Like, what's your option? I mean, Lopez is going to look around and say, I want to make a lot of money.
Right.
Who does top rank have for him that will offer him? Like, you're not going to, like, Miguel Burchelt doesn't move the needle. Like, there's no, I don't see a fight.
He's coming off a loss. On
I don't see a marketable fight other than opening up their wallets and winning a purse bid for a Devin Haney fight.
The Haney fight is the fight that should happen next, but look, we live this every day. What should happen in boxing and what winds up happening are
almost always
I
think that does
things.
A good rating on ESPN if it winds up there. It does a good number at the zone. Like, that's just like both those guys will talk their face off. They'll get each other's face at press conferences.
Well,
it'll be a wild.
One of them will talk their faces off.
One of them. I think even Devin will.
Yeah, I mean, because I think Lopez will bring the best out of him, whereas
the email champion thing is under his skin.
Yeah,
it is
absolutely.
Very
that's
much
good
under
that's
his skin.
That's a good point. And Teofimo Lopez does not miss an opportunity to utter the words "email champion" because he knows how much it irritates Devin Haney.
He does not.
I get it.
He says that every single time.
And you can almost see the glee he takes as it leaves his mouth every time he says it. But as it pertains to Lopez's relationship with Top Rank, it's, you know, I know there was talk about there being litigation because they interfered in the, you know, they feel that Top Rank interfered in the purse bid process. I'm sure he could sue, but ultimately it wound up working out for him as well as imaginable, really.
Yeah.
I mean, he's going to make an enormous amount of money June 19th. You know, so it's hard to say that whatever was done by Top Rank behind the scenes with the zone or whatever, this worked out better for him than anything else could have possibly worked out. So, and then do you want to waste a lot of money in litigation and spending time out of the ring because you won't be able to fight while this is going? It almost serves no purpose.
Top Rank, you complain, and understandably, that, you know, Crawford's losing you money because you got to pay him X. Like, do you really want to waste? Like, I know it's a tough pill to swallow if you wind up losing a purse bid and Teo goes and fights on DAZN or wherever, but like, Teofimo versus some middling 135 is not going to move the needle. It's just throwing away money to a degree. So why not just roll the dice? Like, I mean, it's not the same thing, and I like to compare what Teo does to what happened with Jose Ramirez and Maurice Hooker, but, like, if Teofimo beats Devin Haney, he comes back from that a massive star income and probably a bigger pay-per-view draw on ESPN. Like, I just... Yeah. It just... However it works out, that fight needs to happen next. Like, Ryan Garcia is doing his own thing right now. He's got to figure his stuff out. That's not an option for either guy. There's nothing else out there at 135.
And because Gervonta Davis seems...
He's going to fight at welterweight
disinterested in fighting at lightweight. I mean, whatever you think of him fighting at 140 pounds, he certainly doesn't seem interested in fighting Teofimo Lopez.
Who is he interested in fighting at this point? I don't know. Like, we've talked about this. The Mario Barrios fight is strange because Barrios is a threat. And I don't know what he gains off it. Like, if I hear, it's on Showtime, right? If I hear anybody talk about the belt, it's a fictional belt.
It's on Showtime pay-per-view.
Showtime pay-per-view, yes. Shout out Steven Espinosa.
The belt thing is nonsense, obviously. Yeah. I mean, he's the second, Josh Taylor is the WBA champion.
Correct.
Everyone with a brain knows that, of course.
This isn't a hard one either. Josh Taylor's got all of them. So it's like, you're talking with 140 pound champion.
Undisputed junior welterweight champion. So, it's almost it's insulting to some extent. Like, why do you keep pressing this issue that he's going to be those belts should not. I don't fault the fighters at all, as I always say. They're just exploiting the system that exists. It gives you leverage. It helps you make more money. I can totally understand. Mario Barrios is going to make more money for this fight than he'll probably ever make in his life. Mm-hmm. So good for him.
Mm-hmm.
But to try then to say Gervonta Davis it's a risky fight, and I do. Despite what people might think of Mario Barrios, I do think there's risk involved here for Davis because
he can
Barrios
punch.
Is a lot bigger than him,
and he can punch.
Yeah, he's not a great.
And Davis
great
has been
fighter,
out. Like, Davis has got power, but he's been outboxed. Like, he's had to rely on that power. Like, even Leo Santa Cruz had his moments until he got flattened. So Davis may have to summon that power. Maybe that power is not there at 140.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because when I asked Teofimo Lopez about this the other day at the workout, he said he thinks he will carry that power up, and that's why they're so confident in taking this fight, despite the size difference. He feels that he will catch, because Lopez said that he thinks, Davis's power is special. So that's the way they must look at it, because Floyd Mayweather and Leonard Ellerbe, they're master matchmakers, and they're not doing this if they don't think unequivocally that Davis is going to win this fight. But it is risky because of the size difference, I think.
When does Davis fight, though? We're now skewing onto Davis, so I didn't plan on talking about today. But when does Davis fight someone they're not sure that he's going to beat? Like, when does that happen? Because there are guys out there, like, marketable fights you can make. I got to go across the street and make a deal. Though, like, let's say Devin Haney beats Teofimo Lopez. Eddie Hearn would have no problem, if Eddie's still working with Devin, to take that fight to Fox or Showtime and do a fight there. No issue whatsoever. Like, when does that happen? Like, I know they're master matchmakers, and they've done an incredible job turning Gervonta not only into a guy that can be on pay-per-view, but an attraction where he fights, a guy that sells tickets where he fights. That is not easy to do for promoters or for fighters. But at some point, you've got to take a chance, right? Like, you've got to roll the dice in a fight that's, like, close to 50-50. I just don't know when that's going to happen for Gervonta Davis.
Could be that they wait everyone else out, let other guys knock each other off, and then maybe fight whoever is left standing. Maybe they do that.
I suppose.
I don't know. I mean, because he's...
Then you're talking about the 130s coming up, because Teofimo was not long for 135. Devin Haney is not long for 135.
And I don't think Davis is going to stay at 140.
That wouldn't be a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, he's a small guy. I mean, he's barely 5'6", really, too. So I don't see him staying at 140. But, unfortunately, what's going on with Ryan Garcia in his personal life changes a lot of things for a lot of guys at lightweight, because that option at the moment is not there. And you hope, of course, he gets well and gets back physically and mentally to where he was before. And then that brings another intriguing option into the mix. But now that he's removed from the mix temporarily, if the Haney-Lopez fight happens next, we always talk about these young lightweights that are contemporaries and they should all fight each other. Well, if Garcia's not fighting for the moment and Haney and Lopez fight each other, well, then all three of those guys are out of the mix for Davis at that point anyway.
Another year goes by, and you just kind of...
And he's 20, I think he's 26 now,
26,
I believe.
He's got time, but like, he's wasted years, just at least fight one top opponent once a year. Yeah. I don't know. Is that too much to ask at this point?
Like, I think we'll learn a lot on June 26th when we see how he handles a 140-pounder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he just blows through Mario Barrios somehow...
Mm-hmm.
And isn't fazed by fighting a much bigger opponent, maybe that gives them more confidence to do the type of fights that they have not yet done at lower weight classes.
I'm not optimistic at this point. I don't know who's in the PBC universe at 135, but it'll probably be one of those fights at some point.
How about Rancis Bartholomew? Let's get him in there.
Don't put that into the universe. People listen to this podcast, Keith. Keith, good to talk to you, man. I'll see you at the pool later.
Always, yes. 10 a.m.? I'm going to go put on the about 14 pounds of sunblock, and I'll be out there.
You like the wave pool? It's a little good action there at the wave pool. It's, hop in there, you know.
Absolutely.
Yell when the wave comes up. What? No. All right. All right, that's it for this week's episode. My thanks to my guests. As always, subscribe to the podcast over at Apple Podcasts. Rate, review. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.